My talk today is about the recent performance of the U.S. economy, about the prospects for recovery, and about the role of the Federal Reserve in bank supervision. So these may seem like disconnected topics to you, but my main point today is they're not. My goal is to convince you that a healthy U.S. economy requires a Federal Reserve that is actively engaged in bank supervision. Before I continue, I'd like to remind you that the following views are my own and not necessarily those of others in the Federal Reserve System. So let's begin with the status of the economy and its future prospects. Of course, we can't talk about the future without a brief view of the past. We've just experienced an unprecedented recession, unlike anything we've encountered since World War II. From the third quarter of 2008 through the second quarter of 2009, the United States experienced four consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. There is no other such sequence in the post-war period. Not only was the length of this recession unprecedented, it was also largely unanticipated. So most economists did not see this kind of recession coming. Now, I mention this in part as a means of handicapping the forecast you're about to hear from me. So the Romans used to cut up birds to make their forecasts, and our methods have improved the Minneapolis Fed somewhat, but just like in Roman times, it's pretty much caveat emptor when it comes to economic forecasting. Having said that, even very bad recessions do come to an end. There is a nascent recovery underway. As I will describe, I expect it to continue. However, my own forecast is the recovery in GDP and especially unemployment will be slow because of uncertainties relating to various legislative initiatives and problems in the banking sector. I do think the news is mostly good on the inflation front, but the need for careful policy decisions is even more critical than usual. Why do I say that a recovery is underway? Real GDP began to grow again in the third quarter of 2009. In fact, the growth rate accelerated to a seasonally adjusted annualized growth rate of 5.7% in the fourth quarter. My own prediction is the National Bureau of Economic Research will declare this recession to have ended sometime in the second half of last year. However, GDP is not the whole story. It is true that as measured by unemployment, the economy is still stuck in a trough. I will have more to say about that in a few minutes. Will this turnaround in GDP continue in the coming months and years? In November, the minutes of the Federal Open Market Committee included summary measures of the forecasts of the presidents of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks and the governors of the Federal Reserve System. They included forecasts for real GDP for 2010 and 2011. Their predictions are roughly around 3% growth for 2010 and around 4% growth in 2011. These predictions seem to be in step with many private sector forecasts. My own forecast is closer to 3% per year over the next 2 years, not 3.5%. This pessimism derives from two sources. First, our statistical forecasting model at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis is predicting that GDP growth over this period will be around 2.5% per year. So that's much slower than what I mentioned, the consensus among the presidents and the FOMC more generally. The model is a simple one in many ways, but its forecasting track record is surprisingly good. However, my relative pessimism is grounded in more than the statistical model's forecast. I see two areas of concern. First, there is a great deal of uncertainty related to major policy initiatives underway in Washington. Congress is considering proposals for enormous changes in healthcare and in the structure of financial regulation. These proposals have generated a lot of uncertainty, for the capricious winds of politics seem to change them on a near daily basis. As bankers, you know that too much uncertainty makes for a risky loan. The same is true for the economy as a whole. I see this kind of political uncertainty as problematic for the prospects of rapid recovery. Second, the financial markets have largely healed from the traumas of 2007 to 2009. But the banking sector faces ongoing problems. I do not need to tell this group that banks with large amounts of commercial real estate exposure face a corresponding elevated risk of failure. This threat could well lead to continued declines in bank lending, which would curtail the recovery. Even worse, as we saw in the thrift crisis in the 1980s, in the presence of deposit insurance, banks that are near failure have strong incentives to make poor loans. This outcome would be even worse for the economy. So at this point in my talk, I've been discussing broad factors that can affect GDP growth and that have influenced my economic forecast. But as I indicated earlier, as we all well know, GDP does not tell the full story of the impact of recessions. I'm speaking, of course, about unemployment. Over the past 15 years, more and more macroeconomists have begun studying household level data on variables like earnings and consumption, as opposed to just looking at aggregate data, the kind of data you see written about in the newspaper. Much of this work on household level data was done by researchers and consultants at the Federal Reserve of Minneapolis. These data have given us a greater appreciation for the unequal impacts of recessions. So let me give you an example of this. So over the fourth quarter of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009, GDP fell by about 3% per person. So over that six-month period, it fell by about 3% per person. If this fall had been spread uniformly across all people in the United States, it would have been equivalent to everyone's losing between 3 and 4 days' worth of income. This would be difficult, but probably not a cost that would have led Congress to contemplate the redesign of the entire financial regulatory system. The point is that the fall is not spread uniformly across all people. Some workers, those who lose their jobs, suffer a much bigger fall in income. For this reason, many macroeconomists now believe the true cost of a recession is not measured by the fall in GDP alone, but rather by the associated increase in the risk of people becoming and staying unemployed. So unemployment is currently 9.7%. It has been higher in the post-World War II period. It reached 10.8% in the bleak fall of 1982. However, in a 25-year span between January 1984 and January 2009, unemployment never topped 8%. It is safe to say that those who were born after 1968, and I think I could go further than that, people, basically anyone under 50 really, has never experienced an economic episode of this kind in their working lives. The outlook for unemployment is not comforting. Though unemployment has fallen somewhat, forecasts remain uniformly troubling. Unemployment is notoriously slow to recover after recessions and has been especially slow to decline after the last two mild recessions of 1990-91 and 2000-2001. I would be especially surprised if unemployment were below 9% by the end of 2010 or below 8% by the end of 2011. And remember I said unemployment had never been below 8%, excuse me, been above 8%, between 1984 and 2009. Looking at data on job flows is even more disturbing. So we can dig deeper beneath the aggregate data. Much has been made in the media about how employment losses are stabilizing, as if this portends inevitable job growth. The source of this stabilization is problematic. So at the beginning of the fall of 2007, unemployment started to rise. Where did this increase in unemployment start to come from? It's because firms started to cut back on hiring. So, and that meant workers could not find jobs. Firm hiring rates continued to fall and hit their low point in about March of 2009. They've remained at that low point ever since. So the rate at which firms are hiring workers has remained at the March 2009 level up through now, through January. Why then have employment losses slowed? The reason is the rate of layoffs and quits, what economists call the separation rate, has slowed. But declines in the rate of layoffs and quits cannot be viewed as a robust source of employment growth. And in fact, the separation rate is at a historical low for the life of that data set as well. To get a true expansion in employment and in the economy, the hiring rate has to pick up. And we have yet to see evidence that it will do so in the immediate future. Let me end this portion of my talk on a more positive note, but of course with the caveat that follows. The positive news is, in this economy is that inflation has been relatively tame. From the fourth quarter of 2007 to the fourth quarter of 2009, PCE inflation has averaged slightly less than 1.5% per year. Over the same period, core PCE inflation, which takes away the more volatile elements of food and energy, has averaged about 1.7% per year. So basically, the Fed is keeping inflation at levels consistent with good long-run economic performance, which I would say is, myself, somewhere between 1.5% and 2.5%. Here's a caveat. Deposit institutions are holding over $1 trillion of excess reserves. That's over 15 times what they're required to hold given their deposits. These excess reserves create the potential for high inflation. And here's how that might work. If households start to believe that prices are going to rise, then they're going to demand more deposits to use for their transactions. Banks, because they're holding all these extra reserves, can readily accommodate this extra demand for deposits. Now, it's just your basic story from what you heard in your first year economics class. These extra deposits become extra money chasing the same amount of goods out there in the economy. So in this way, and that ends up generating upward pressure on prices. In this way, the expectations of households about inflation, if they start to believe inflation is going to come along, those are self-fulfilling, and inflation will, in fact, resolve. Why might households expect this, an increase in inflation? Well, the amount of federal government debt held by the private sector has gone up by over 30% since the beginning of 2008. This debt can only be paid off in two ways, by tax collections, by the Fed printing the money to pay it off, what we call monetization. If households begin to expect that monetization will take place, that the Fed will be printing dollars to pay off the debt, even if they're wrong about this, their expectations will rise as well and can be manifested in inflation itself. Now, I want to say, and I want to stress this, I view this scenario as unlikely. For it to take place, we would need a combination of bad monetary policy and bad fiscal management. I do not foresee this combination as likely to occur. Of course, I'm part of the FOMC, so. Nonetheless, good policy requires good choices. And policymakers at the Federal Reserve and in Congress need to keep this potential scenario in mind when making their decisions. And I can assure you that we in the Federal Reserve have every intention of keeping our end of this bargain. So to summarize my economic forecast, I do think the economy is on the mend and should continue to recover over the next 2 years in terms of both GDP and unemployment, but at slower rates than we would like. The outlook for inflation is basically promising, as long as the Federal Reserve and Congress work together appropriately. So my discussion leaves out the main way that the economy has improved in the last 18 months. We face a lot less uncertainty. So let me take you back to September 2008. At that time, almost all believed that a horrific economic collapse, already named Depression 2.0, was possible. Indeed, many believed it was inevitable. Real GDP did fall by over 3.5% from the end of 2007 through the middle of 2009. Unemployment did double from the end of 2007 to the end of 2009. Those numbers are shocking numbers. It cannot be emphasized enough how they pale in comparison to their analogs from the Great Depression. From 1929 through 1933, real GDP in the United States fell by 27%, by one quarter. Unemployment rose from 3.2% to 25%. So one in four workers was unemployed in 1933. Today, unlike in September 2008, this type of catastrophic economic collapse is no longer in the menu of likely or even plausible events. We've seen an improvement in economic uncertainty. How did this improvement in the level of economic uncertainty come about? And the answer to this question brings me to the second part of my talk. My theme here is that the improvement in our economic situation, this improvement in our economic situation, about the, in terms of the level of uncertainty, is attributable in large part to actions taken by the Federal Reserve. And I will emphasize to you that the Federal Reserve is only able to undertake these actions because of expertise and information that it acquired as a supervisor of the nation's banks. My conclusion is that stripping the Federal Reserve of its supervisory role would needlessly put the Great Depression on the menu of possibilities for our country in some future financial crisis. Let's begin by recollecting the state of the financial world in September 2008. The problem was that the world was in the midst of a financial panic that had started a year earlier. So what's a financial panic? They're basically events in which the line between liquidity and solvency becomes blurred. So, and now we have to define more terms. What's the distinction between liquidity and solvency? So a firm is solvent if its revenues, in a discounted present value sense, exceed its expenditures. A firm is liquid if it is able to raise enough funds, either by borrowing or by selling assets, to pay its current costs. So in a well-functioning financial market, the solvent firms are typically liquid firms because they can borrow against their future revenues. In contrast, in a financial panic, lenders feel unable to assess the resources or the collateral of borrowers. Borrowing becomes highly constrained, and even highly solvent firms may become illiquid. In severe financial panics, like the one that took place in the Great Depression, the shortages of liquidity can eliminate large amounts of GDP and large numbers of jobs. It was exactly this possibility that we faced in the fall of 2008. The actions of the Fed were instrumental in ensuring that this eventuality did not take place. Beginning in the fall of 2007, the Fed undertook a number of critical interventions designed to enhance the functioning of financial markets. In the remainder of the speech, I'm going to go through two of them in some detail. I will pay particular attention to the role that our experience as a bank supervisor played in the success of these interventions. Okay, so the first intervention is a traditional one. In any economy, one of the main jobs of the central bank is to make sure that both the quantity and the allocation of liquidity are appropriate. In terms of the quantity of liquidity, the central bank's tool is a targeted short-term interest rate, the Fed funds rate. In terms of the allocation of liquidity, the central bank's tool is a discount window. During the recent financial crisis, the Federal Reserve used a discount window in a truly massive way. I'm smiling because these numbers are just so awe-inspiring to me. But on July 25th, 2007, the Fed had $246 million of discount window loans outstanding to depository institutions. At the end of 2008, the Fed had nearly $90 billion of such loans outstanding. That's a 36,000% increase. But even this enormous increase is really a vast underestimate of what the Fed did. In late 2007, the Fed became concerned that the traditional discount window was being underutilized. It opened what was known as the Term Auction Facility, the TAF, the TAF, which allowed depository institutions to bid on loans from the Fed. Through this facility, at the end of 2008, the Fed had $450 billion of loans outstanding to depository institutions. So remember, at the beginning I said $246 million. Now the combined total is $540 billion to financial institutions from the TAF and the discount window. This is a 200,000% increase, a 2,000-fold increase over July 2007. We do not know the impact of this lending of the financial sector with certainty. However, it seems reasonable to presume that it was essential in keeping solvent financial institutions afloat during the height of the financial crisis. There is compelling supporting evidence for this, too, in aggregate loan data. So if you go look at total liabilities for U.S. chartered commercial banks, they grew by $1.2 trillion from the third quarter of 2007 to the fourth quarter of 2008. Loans from the Federal Reserve, as I just described, that $540 billion accounts for nearly half of this $1.2 trillion increase. Okay. Now, it's important to emphasize the Fed did not use these facilities to simply hand out money to banks. In financial panic, public policy has two goals. One, which I've stressed already, is to make sure that illiquid but solvent firms survive. You want the illiquid but the solvent firms to survive. The other is to make sure that the truly insolvent firms fail. So for this reason, the Fed only made loans to sufficiently high-quality financial institutions through the discount window in the TAF. But this kind of intervention, this selective intervention, requires the Fed to have good information about any financial institution that is a prospective borrower. Now, under our existing regulatory system, the Fed could turn to its own supervisors for this information and the ability to evaluate that information. But suppose instead that, as has been proposed by Senator Christopher Dodd and others, the Fed had no supervisory authority. How would the discount window or the TAF have worked? Given any financial institution that wanted to borrow, the Fed would have had to call that institution's regulator and ask for information about the institution's quality. So I see two distinct problems with such an arrangement. The first is purely logistical. During a crisis like 2007 to 2009, this other regulator would face huge resource demands in terms of obtaining and sharing information about an institution's quality. Remember, we're talking about a 2,000-fold increase in the use of these facilities. Getting the phone answered in a timely fashion about a given financial institution might well be extremely challenging. But the bigger problem is one of incentives. And as an economist, I'll always be emphasizing incentives. Under the current system, if the Fed makes a bad loan through the TAF or the discount window, that loss appears on its balance sheet, on our balance sheet. It has every incentive to do a good job in assessing borrowing quality. Now, suppose instead that some other agency were responsible for providing this information to the Fed. What exactly are this other agency's incentives to provide the Fed with the best possible information? This other agency is not going to suffer the loss from making a bad loan. The Fed is. Indeed, one can readily imagine that in the politically charged circumstances of a financial panic, this other agency's objective might be to keep as many banks alive as possible. In these circumstances, the Fed would have no way to obtain reliable information from this other regulatory body and would have no way to make the appropriately targeted loans. As it is, the Fed has not lost any money on either TAF or discount window loans made during this period. So I've talked about one traditional intervention that the Fed undertook in a massive way. Let me talk next about a less traditional intervention, the Supervisory Capital Assessment Program. That is the bank stress test. So through March and April of 2009, the Fed and other federal bank supervisors conducted an assessment of the capital needs of the 19 large bank holding companies under a benchmark macroeconomic scenario and a hopefully unrealistic adverse scenario. The study released bank-level information about risk exposure of various kinds. It was extremely valuable, I think, most onlookers agree, in restoring market confidence in the viability of the large American banks. The Fed played the leading role in the implementation of the stress test. Now, in part, this leading role arose because, from a legal perspective, we were the primary regulator of the various bank holding companies. But there was also a more fundamental reason for the Fed taking this lead. By its very nature, a good central bank needs expertise in a wide range of areas: supervision, monetary economics, financial markets, and macroeconomics. The stress test required exactly the same range of expertise. Playing the leading role in the stress test was an intrinsic outgrowth of the Fed's multitasking role in the economy. Now, suppose, again, that the Fed did not have supervisory authority over the banks. Then no institution of the government would have had the collective expertise to orchestrate a stress test for the large banks. My guess is this test would never have taken place. Along these lines, it is worth noting that countries with divisions between supervision and monetary policy did not undertake exercises similar to the stress test. Indeed, one could go further. Suppose that the Fed had responsibilities for systemic risk regulation, as is proposed in the House Financial Regulation Bill that was passed in December. My belief is that under this proposed regulatory structure, the stress test would have been better in terms of both its form and its timing. So in terms of form, the May stress test studied the 19 target institutions in a parallel but entirely separate fashion, so just parallel tracks. The test did not gauge the institutions' interactions with each other or with other financial entities. The whole point of systemic regulation is the stress test done by such a regulator would have included those critical elements of interaction. Now, in terms of timing, the stress test took over 2 months from inception to finish. In late 2008, and I'm sure you all remember this, the speed of events was such that 2 months seemed like an eternity. We were getting years of information every day, it seemed like. If the Federal Reserve had been a systemic regulator, the stress test would have been much less resource intensive, because it would have been a natural outgrowth of what the Federal Reserve was obligated to do. It is not difficult to imagine this cheaper stress test would have taken place in October or November of 2008. Now, at that point in time, interbank lending markets were still significantly dislocated. At least some of those stresses were attributable to lenders lacking good information about the portfolios, potential borrowers, and their financial connections. My own view is that a November stress test with its associated release of bank-specific information would have been enormously helpful. Now, discount window lending and the stress test are but two of the interventions that the Fed undertook in response to the financial crisis. I have hope that I've convinced you that these interventions would have been significantly more difficult, if not actually impossible, in a world in which the Fed did not have a supervisory role. The Fed undertook a number of other broad-based market interventions to provide liquidity to solvent firms. And here I want to emphasize that I am not talking about the targeted injections of funds into Bear Stearns or AIG. Those injections were designed to achieve objectives other than the provision of liquidity, which is what I've been talking about. Rather, I'm talking about interventions like the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, under which the Fed purchased a broad range of asset-backed securities from a large number of sellers. I won't go into detail about these other lending facilities, except that note that all of these interventions were highly complex. The Fed's expertise in banking supervision was essential in their design and their implementation. Would we have had Depression 2.0 without the Fed's using this range of policies? We will never know for sure. I can assure you, as an academic, people will be writing papers about that question 50 years from now. However, it is clear to me these policies worked as intended. They kept illiquid but solvent firms alive during the course of the financial crisis while letting truly insolvent firms fail. In so doing, these policies eliminated the possibility of Depression 2.0. My remarks are focused on the Fed's ability to stop a financial crisis from creating a Great Depression. I've done so because I believe that ability is truly critical. Don't get me wrong, we can and should do a better job of financial regulation so that we minimize the likelihood of a financial crisis ever taking place. In the 2000s, the Federal Reserve made some significant mistakes along these lines, as did the FDIC, the OCC, the OTS, and regulators in many other countries. As the Minneapolis Federal Reserve has been urging for over 30 years, politicians and regulators need to create incentives that will lead financial firms to avoid risks that end up costing taxpayers. However, no financial regulatory scheme will ever be perfect. Whatever we do about financial regulation, at some point in the future, investors and regulators will again confuse the unlikely and the impossible. Their mistake will create the next financial crisis. Right now, our regulatory system has the ability to prevent those crises from generating 30% falls in output and 25% unemployment. When changing the system, we have to make sure it doesn't lose that ability. Stripping the Fed of its role and supervision is a step in the wrong direction. Making it the systemic risk regulator is a step in the right direction. Thank you once again for this opportunity, and I welcome your questions.